Hi, everyone. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. It's Wednesday, September 29, 2021. I'm Dr. Brad Reedy. Tonight's broadcast is a live question and answer. So you can ask any question or topic. I'll also get to all the pre-submitted questions first. Remember, with these, you can invite family and friends to these. You can invite siblings of your child to these if you'd like to. You're welcome to share these particular links with family and friends. You can ask questions about family and friends, siblings. You can also ask questions for family and friends, siblings. Sometimes I like to suggest that ask a question of me that you've been asked and listen to my answer and see how you might compare your answer to that one. So with that, let's get into the pre-submitted questions. Like I said, we have a decent list beginning this evening, so I'll get right into the first one. The first question I have, it says, you said that you brought your son home from residential treatment when you were ready, rather than waiting for them to say he was ready. How do you know that you were ready? What if he had been ready before you? I'll answer the last question first. I've talked about the fact that really the decision is about when you're ready. I should be clear that figuring into that is going to be your child's progress, the therapist's report, perspective, prognosis of your child, right? There's going to be a whole lot of outside information that you're going to take in, but essentially you're arriving at a point where you're saying, I'm ready for the challenge. I'm ready for the opportunity. The question of what if my son was ready before me, would I take him home? My answer is of course not, right? And in essence, it's kind of like lining up two independent variables. I don't even know what it means for him to be ready and me not to be ready in a sense, because his level of progress and functioning is going to inform my readiness at taking my child home after a wilderness program or a therapeutic program. But I think it's ultimately taking responsibility and accountability for your own decision. Sometimes I'll talk to clients about, look, the kind of progress in the work that you do will influence your parents to move you to the next setting, to bring you home after treatment. I want you to think about that and to consider that. But ultimately, if we tell children or spouses for that matter, or any other loved one, if we tell them that it's up to them and their behavior, when we'll accept them home after a treatment program like ours, I think we take away the responsibility we have to decide. I don't like to say to students of our program, for example, you're here because of your choices. At least simply, I don't. I like to acknowledge the fact that you're here because your parents were concerned that things weren't going well at home and they didn't think that they could give you what you needed. Now, like in all healthy thinking and all mental health thought processes, I can talk with a client about, look, let's talk about your contribution to that perception that they have. Let's talk about the impact or the influence of your choices on your parents' opinion. But I want to steer away from simple cause and effect, because it gets us onto a really slippery slope. And then we get to blame each other. And ultimately, at the end of the day, after all of the information is provided to you, it's your decision to make. If your child is an adolescent or is not doesn't have an adult status legally. If the child is an adult, then them leaving is up to them and you, and they can walk out of the program any day that they want. You can't keep an adult, at least in our program. You can in a very highly acute situation for suicidality or harm to others. But those are still going to be time limited, 24, 48, 72 hours typically. But for the purposes of Evoke's Wilderness Therapy Program and the story that I shared, I'm just acknowledging my responsibility in the choice. Similar to the way that I feel about trusting somebody, you get to decide, and it's important and healthy for you to own whether or not you trust somebody. Now, how honest they are, how forthright they are, how transparent they are, how much integrity they display, all of that is going to inform you, but ultimately you're responsible for the decision to trust or to not trust. And you can own that. You don't have to apologize for it. You don't have to prove that you're trusting at the appropriate level. I'll say to clients on both sides of the equation, both parent and child, at times, there are children that are less honest than you, whose parents trust them. And there are children who are more honest than you, whose parents don't trust them. So I think when I talk about I was ready for him to come home, I was just taking responsibility for simply what is the fact of the matter, which is I get to decide. And hopefully, for all of us, including me, we're open to listening to professional opinions. But at some point, and this is important, at some point, you get to say to the professionals that you're working with, you have to get behind me. If a client arrives at the point where they're saying, I'm not willing to hear, I don't need you to convince me anymore, now I need you to support my decision the best you can, you get to ask for that. I think there's embedded in this question and this idea tonight about the relationship that we have with therapists. And like I've said many times, and a very core value to mine is, it's important that we have the safety to speak our voice and our mind to people in authority. And therapists, ideally, will set an example about what it's like to listen to somebody who takes the risk to say something difficult or scary to a person in authority. So I hope that helps. I hope that helps. Somebody writes, I see an introvert as someone who is content with their own company. What distinguishes the introvert from the balanced person, referring to the differentiation scale you referred to reviewed Monday night? Introversion is not on that scale. You can be quiet and introverted and be codependent and anxious and enmeshed. And you can be outspoken and very social and be healthy or unhealthy. So the two really don't. That's the difficult thing about being a therapist or being a coach, is that the behavior doesn't tell the full story. When you make a decision for your child, I don't know necessarily from the decision you've made if it's a healthy or an unhealthy decision, if it's a decision born out of fear or anxiety or control, or one born out of courage, authenticity, and love. I don't know the difference. The only way that I can know the difference is if you talk to me about it. Where's this coming from? Tell me your thoughts. Tell me about the decision-making process. So quietness or introversion, I agree with you. I consider myself in most situations socially an introvert. Publicly, when I speak, when I teach at work, I don't come across as an introvert, but socially I do. And in a lot of ways, that introversion is just about, like you said, me being comfortable with myself, me enjoying the company of myself. Somebody writes, I am looking for support for siblings. Can you recommend any resources? Do you do any sibling support groups? This is an interesting question. I want to tell you a little bit about the history of working with siblings. We have had sibling groups in the field during summertime. We've had siblings come out to the field for kind of a quasi-therapeutic wilderness program where they're there to work on communication and relationships with their siblings. We've had sibling support groups. So we've offered a decent array of sibling supports, sibling treatment options. But generally what we get is one of two categories. A child that really qualifies for our traditional wilderness program, right? They probably would be better seen as a client than the sibling of a client. So they're more acute than their parents are assessing. Or number two, they're not very motivated. I think when parents, and I would open up sibling support groups tomorrow. I would open up another sibling group in the field if we could fill it at all, enough to just break even. I would really do that. But the fact of the matter is, oftentimes the question or the desire for sibling support services is really the parent's issue. The parent is feeling anxious. The parent is wanting something for the sibling that the sibling doesn't want for themselves. So again, thinking about Evokes Wilderness Therapy Program, ultimately you're making the decision to send your child here because they're not making the decisions they need to for their life. And it's arrived at a level at a certain threshold that you've made the decision that I'm sending you to this program for adolescents, that is, whether you like it or not, whether you agree to it or not. Because if I rely on your decisions going forward, from our recent, you know, track record, things aren't going to be going well. You're not going to be safe. So that's the way we think about clients. But for sibling support, more often than not, honestly, the solution is parent support. More than 90% of the time, and I just picked that number off the top of my head, is I could probably get a lot closer to 100% of the time. Almost always when I'm talking to a parent about the support that a sibling and of an identified patient needs or they think they need, you're really talking about a parent's ability to manage it, what to say, how to hold space, what's appropriate to kind of push for the sibling to work on versus taking some space and letting the sibling sort it out themselves. So we've done it before, and I don't know any other sibling programs, but the fact of the matter is, most of the time, I think it really boils down to giving parents education, support, tools to be able to help the non-identified patient, the sibling of a child in our program. Thanks for the question. Great question and not uncommon at all. The next question reads this way. My question is this. When two selves are taking care of their own needs and setting their boundaries, what happens when the gap exists and responsibility between these two selves? If there's a gap that exists between the responsibility of these two selves, what happens when the needs of one self are in conflict with the needs and boundaries of another self? And this is further complicated by the power dynamic of a parent-child relationship. As a child of a narcissist, I'm working very hard in the uncomfortable space of creating my own boundaries. Sometimes as a response, I am unwilling to compromise because I've already compromised myself my whole life. Not only do I welcome this question, but I want to reward it and say to all of you, this is the question of your life. How much is too much? We know that relationships require sacrifice. We know that relationships require negotiation. And in every relationship, not everybody's needs can be met at the same time. That's why it's so important to have external to the family sources of support, like a therapist, like a 12-step support group or community, like a sponsor. We know those things are important and valuable for many families. But the question is, when does it become too far apart? When does the responsibilities that each is carrying become out of balance? That's your question to answer. That's the question about being a self. I get asked over and over again in lots of different ways. When am I being too selfish? When am I being a pushover? Am I being a doormat? Am I being too rigid? Can I set that boundary? Can I set this boundary? Should I give it into this? A lot of the questions start with should, right? And when I'm asked those questions, I'll often respond with simply, it's the right question. And it's yours to answer. And there's no way that I can answer it for you. Because the answer is about where's your line. Like I said on Monday night, even when you're setting healthy boundaries that most everybody would agree about, you're going to be thought of as selfish and uncaring and unloving, right? That's the change back energy that we have to resist. That's the kind of energy that often aligns with our parents' parenting that was meant to keep us in place, to take care of other people's needs. So the process, you guys, of becoming a self is messy and imperfect. In attachment-based therapy, in the therapy that we do at Evoke, in the therapy that I talk about on these podcasts, the goal is to become who you are, to become your authentic self. And there's no perfectly efficient way to do that. And you're going to make mistakes. And you're going to take detours. And sometimes it's two steps forward and four steps back. Sometimes we have to run into the same dead end, right? Make the same mistake more than once just to be sure it's a mistake. This is all about becoming a person. And if you're thinking, well, gosh, that's not how I've parented. Well, this is part of the wake-up call. You know, I had my own challenges with my children throughout the years. I have them still to this day. Just this weekend when I was presented with a fairly acute challenge, I was thinking to myself on Saturday and Sunday, and I probably thought about it and using more adult language, I thought, parenting is hard. Parenting is really difficult stuff. And even when you know or embrace the philosophy like I aspire to believe and to live, that there's no ultimately objective right choice. It's about figuring yourself out and figuring out where your lines and your boundaries stand with your children. Even when you know that it's still up to you, it's still about becoming a self, it's really, really, really hard. And remember this, that in many cases, I don't know if I said this on Monday night, I don't know if I've even said this lately, but in many cases, if you do the right thing in parenting, most of the people around you are going to think you're doing the wrong thing. Think about that. This is not what I teach, and that's why you're here tonight, and that's why you listen to the podcast. What I teach is not common sense. It's uncommon sense. And in fact, like I talked about recently, the process of becoming who you are means that maybe more than anything, you have to unlearn things that you were taught. So figuring out where the lines are, how to deal with it is up to you. And of course, you know, the nuclear option is always available, which is I'm done with you. If it's a child, it's a little bit more complicated because you can't just kick them out of the house if they're under 18. But in most of our relationships, the nuclear option is available, which means I'm divorcing you or I'm having nothing to do with you as a friend or as a child even, or as a parent. All of those are available to us, and we don't have to reach those every day, all the time with people in our lives. But that's kind of the ultimate option. It'll be the option for your child. I mean, if your child grows up and becomes healthy like we want them to, at some point, ideally, they'll want to be in relationship with you, not because of some obligation, right? Obligation is in some respects a core element of pathology. In toxic families, people operate from obligation often. It's a driving force. But eventually it's going to be to a point where we all want our children to be financially independent and functional and living a meaningful life. Eventually, earning their company comes because of the way that we are with them, that they want to be around us. I think that's the ultimate goal. So where you set the boundaries is completely up to you. I had a friend text me this idea today. I want to share it with you. He said, it's a quote from Ram Dass. He passed it on to me. He said, all you can do for another person is be in an environment in which if they wanted to come up for air, they could. You know, you want to be there for your child when they're in crisis. You want to be the first phone call when they're stuck or in a corner. And so when they come to you, it won't be, I told you so, or met with a tremendous amount of anxiety or anger or disappointment. You're developing. That's what you're doing here right now. You're developing a sense, a greater capacity to hold people. And that greater capacity is built firmly on the foundation of you healing and becoming more whole as a person, as a self. To summarize, being a person is messy and difficult. And generally speaking, we are not taught how to be a person. We're taught how to be a good thing, a right thing, a successful thing. And those are only slivers of what it means to be a human being. somebody writes in your enmeshment webinar, you talked about the differentiation scale from 0 to 100. And I think that you said that we are attracted to people with a comparable score and bring up children to share that value as well. Is a young child inherently lower on the differentiation scale? Does a child's score increase as they get older? At what age do they level off? If you feel your teen is expecting you to sacrifice yourself for their needs, is that then a sign of immaturity? The model is more vague than what you're asking, but let me answer some of your questions. Yes, developmentally, we improve to some small degree on the differentiation scale. But ultimately, in essence, our children learn from the youngest age. There's a wonderful quote from Tion Dayton, and I don't have it pulled up. I should have pulled it up earlier because I wanted to share it with you tonight anyway. She says, we don't learn from our parents from the things that they tell us, the things that they say. We learn to soak up the emotional energy, the emotional climate in the family. This is the kind of thing I was talking about on Monday with enmeshment. We learn the separation and connection to self by the way our parents are with us. Even young children, when they fall and scrape their knee. You've seen this as a parent. I know you have. Watch the differences in the way that people respond to that child. When a child is throwing a tantrum or nagging us in the checkout line of a grocery store where some cruel, evil person has placed candy at the eye level of a child, right when we're about to check out of the grocery store, at the end of the chore. How we respond to the nagging and the tantrum tells our child how responsible we feel for their feelings, how much we want to control and manage their feelings. So we learn it from a young age through millions of small, sort of invisible interactions. But stress can reduce your differentiation scale, right? Stimulus can change it. When you feel safe in relationships, you move up and up a couple of notches. And yes, finally, over the course of your life, if you're open to it, you can move yourself up the scale. But I want to say it's not inevitable. That's why I'm hesitating, because it's not merely a function of somebody's age or development. You can go backwards on the scale. If your family or your circumstances or your situation changes, if you experience new or chronic trauma as you go, that scale can go lower and lower and lower. You can move further and further down the scale, I should say. So it's not purely developmental. It's mildly impacted by development. But really, you know, I remember before we were married and my wife had a cat for a little while. And I can see the similarities between how she related to the cat and how she relates to our child. How I relate to and feed my dog, how much my dog whines and barks, is to some degree related to my differentiation number. So you see, how I am with people teaches them about how human beings are. I am teaching my children and the people around me with every interaction how responsible I am, and thus how responsible people are in general for each other's feelings. So, wonderful question. Somebody writes, do you have any names of similar wilderness or therapeutic boarding school programs overseas? I don't. I would recommend an educational consultant. In fact, we had a guest on here who specialized in expats and families that are overseas. You can reach out to me at brad@evoketherapy.com or webinar@evoketherapy.com. And I'm happy to give you her name if you don't already have a consultant. But and one of the limitations that I want to just say on this broadcast, it's in the first slide that I show often while I'm waiting to start, is that I won't make recommendations or comment on other programs one way or the other. So my recommendation, the same thing I would do if I was needing it, is I would hire a consultant. I did hire a consultant with my child after I had more than a decade of experience in the field. So I believe in the role, and you can email me for the exact name and contact information if you don't have one, for somebody who specializes in the kinds of situations you're talking about. Somebody writes, is it possible to have healthy, authentic relationships with everyone in your life except for one person? I'm working hard on boundaries and self-care with almost everyone in my life. My mom brings a lot of codependency and narcissism to our relationship. We have both suffered multiple big traumas, loss of a husband, loss of one son due to leukemia as a child, and loss of one son to suicide at age 30. In some ways, I'm all she has left. I know if I try to take care of myself, she will see it as a threat and an insult. I cannot bring myself to be more the cause of any more pain for her. Most of the time, I pretend to be her good daughter. What if I can be a self with everyone in my life except for my mother? Will that be enough? Thank you for the question. I mean, obviously, on a personal level, you can do whatever you want. You can be whatever you want. And yes, some people, some presentations trigger me, trigger you more than others. I've said I'm actually less codependent with my mother and my father than with most people, but that's because I've done a lot of work on them. But I was talking to somebody today and I realized, yes, I'm doing really well with my boundaries with my mother, but the impact of her parenting on me as a child still impacts the way that I think about relationships with my wife, with the mail carrier, right? With the person knocking on my door trying to sell pesticides. So yes, we have different triggers. We have different styles that pull us in more than others. And it sounds like you also have a tremendous amount of trauma that you share with your mother. So those things can drop us down on the scale. The number that we have on the scale, if you haven't listened to it yet, it's the last broadcast I did on enmeshment on Monday night. You can listen to it on our podcast app right away or the YouTube channel. The number is the kind of average. But in different moments with different people, with different triggers, we can move one way or the other with it a little bit. But that's our kind of baseline. But I do want to say this. You know, I like to measure myself by the person with whom I'm most codependent, not least codependent, in terms of my progress. Students, you know, adolescent students have said to me over the years, well, I get along with everybody except for my family. And I responded to them and I'd said, well, everybody's easy to get along with except for your family. I mean, if you can't get along with friends and acquaintances, you're really crazy. Because with friends and acquaintances, you can walk away. You can go home. You don't have to live with them. Ram Dass said, if you think you're enlightened, spend a week with your family. How about with the holidays coming up? We can all look forward to lots of regression when we go home for the holidays or we have people over to our house. We can turn into a 16-year-old kid. I hear all the time clients tell me when their mother or father talk to them, even when they're in their 30s or 40s or in their 50s, they'll say, I feel like a 15-year-old child again. So regression can exist, but I like to measure myself with the people in my life that I have the biggest triggers, that I'm the least differentiated from, that I have the most conflict with. And like I say to our clients, you know, starting with mom and dad, siblings, our spouses and our children, those are really the measuring sticks that we can measure ourselves and our mental health. The friends, the acquaintances, that generally speaking is going to be easier. And if we measure ourselves by those relationships, we'll have a pretty high opinion of ourselves that I think is not necessarily realistic and not a good assessment of the internal workings and dynamics of ourselves, of who we are. Thank you for that. Somebody writes, I have been listening to your podcast for a year and a half and have truly found more peace and am figuring out what myself means. I'm working on my anxious attachment, attend CODA, for parents routinely and have a therapist. Currently, my daughter is at a residential treatment center for trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, and anxiety. The therapist, the PsyD, I assume that means, the PsyD recommended SMART recovery over AA or 12-step. I'm having a hard time finding what their program is about or finding the meeting format. He stated 12 steps are the community-led, and SMART recovery is professionally-led. 12-step seems more relational work, and SMART recovery seems more skill-based. Do you have any experience with SR? I don't think my daughter is addicted to, in the strict sense. She needs help with coping and finding self, not using an outside source for comfort. For example, alcohol, drugs, relationships, internets, gaming, and so forth. More of the enmeshment work we have set up in our family. I would have to brush up on SMART recovery. I'm not an expert on it by any means. And what you've said resonates. It's a very logical, rational-based program. It doesn't need or require the individual to admit that they're powerless. That's a big draw for SMART recovery, is it's saying you have power over your addiction. And 12-step recovery talks about powerlessness. They're right to talk about one is community-driven versus one is professionally-driven. But the fact of the matter is, whatever works. Whatever works. Long ago, I abandoned the belief that I do know and that I even should know what somebody's going to need in their life going forward to maintain a healthy trajectory. I want to offer them tools. I will give my perspective or opinion if I see it. Saying things like, it seems like you feel really lonely. I could see you benefiting from the community of 12-step. Or you seem really resistant to authority figures. And so hearing it from a non-paid peer or sponsor might be more effective. Or it seems like you're really struggling with the higher power, the idea of surrender, the idea of powerlessness. All of those are very nuanced spiritual terms, which if talked about or understood in more practical and pragmatic ways, don't make any sense, right? You have to understand levels and layers to think about surrender and powerlessness and higher power. So maybe you would be attracted to or benefit more from a SMART recovery program. Programs that talk about minimizing the damage versus abstinence. I mean, part of it is that's what you're going to have to figure out. I'm not talking to the mom and the dad right now, but if I'm talking to the individual who suffers from substance use disorder, I would say to them, I don't know if you're an addict or not. In fact, it's not my job to know, not in a spiritual sense. I have to put something on my diagnosis when I file my paperwork, but outside of that, it doesn't matter what I think. You have to figure out your relationship with alcohol and drugs, gaming, the internet, and so forth. So let's talk about what works for you, what you're needing, and what might be something, some approach that we could plug into your life that would help you. Or let's at least introduce you to a couple of options. And then if you find yourself struggling with the effects of substance use or other addictions, then you can choose. So I think it's worthy of education, exploration, and to understand why. I'd say what's the benefit? I'll tell you my fear. My fear is that the therapist likes SMART recovery better, and the therapist has a bias in this case against 12-step recovery programs. That's my suspicion. You don't say that in your question, but that's my suspicion. And if that's true, if my suspicion is true, that's a problem. That's bad therapy. You know, I would ask somebody, how many people do you recommend to 12-step versus SMART? Now, if they say something like, well, I don't know that it's really helpful to identify that a 16-year-old smoking pot every day is an addict and needs to be abstinent and practice daily recovery for the rest of their life. And so I like to start off with SMART recovery. I would say, okay, that makes sense. But if you have a theoretical bias that you're applying broadly, I have a problem with that. I really do. I know too many human beings on earth who attribute their being alive to 12-step programs. And when I hear all this nonsense and debate about what's better, this approach or that approach, my thought is, that's just ego. Let's try to match the client up with what seems to fit for them. And if we don't know what fits, let's give them more than one option and discuss those. So that's kind of my suspicion from your question, is that they have a bias themselves. And for me, that's, I think that's a problem. And I think it's pretty common, not uncommon at all. Somebody writes, I have concerns that make me want to keep my 13-year-old from spending time with a certain friend. My 13-year-old wants to know those reasons, but I don't feel comfortable sharing any of them. I've told them that as a parent at this stage, I can decide who he spends time with outside of school or other events. As he is an older teen, I won't be able to limit it, obviously. I'm also aware that restricting certain friends or limiting the time he spends with certain friends will increase his desire to possibly be with them. All the more, any thoughts on this? I think you've thought about the pros and cons pretty clearly in your question. The first part of your thought is, of course, you have the right as the parent of a teen to set some pretty strict boundaries if you want to. But I think, like you said, if they're in the same school, unless you're willing to take it to the level that you're going to monitor them and their company 24 hours a day, you can't limit it. And so for some, it just practically speaking, it's too much to try to limit friends. It's too much to try to dictate who your child makes as a friend or not. So I think it's overall practically a losing proposition, but you can set some limits around it if you want to. I've never done it before. In my 28 years as a parent, I've never made that a focus. I've never made one specific person a focus, even when my child have struggled or made decisions, or I have thought that a particular peer is less healthy than one or the other. Like always, for me, the primary goal is building a relationship where we can have some honest and open communication, where I'm focused on, I would be interested in what makes a child susceptible to negative peer influences. What are they getting out of it? You know, one of the things when we talk about our children's peers is that if they're around the wrong crowd, which I hear a lot, and I point out, you know, your child is one of the wrong crowd too, to somebody else's child, another parent. So, more important is, what are they getting out of those friendships? Yes, it comes with some pretty negative side effects and some pretty poor decisions and dangerous behaviors that we can attend to and set boundaries around for sure. But they're usually also attracted because they feel a sense of non-judgment or acceptance, even though it might be contingent on negative behaviors like using drugs. The experience is that it's still a lower bar to get over, to be accepted, to fit in, and to belong than it is with my family. So I think the question appears is more complex. I usually don't spend a lot of time believing, thinking, both as a parent and as a professional, that managing the peer group is really important, unless the child is just at a place where they need to go to a program like Evoke, right? Where everything that they're doing and all of their peers and all their relationships are contributing to this general problem or this specific problem that we have that needs treatment. When I've never banned my child from being friends with one person or another. I have grounded them from all friends for a time. But that's because I don't put a lot of emphasis on the particular person. out there. You know, I told you this story recently about a dad who didn't want his adult daughter, when she came home after our program, didn't want her to hang out with her old boyfriend, who the father saw as a real negative influence. And he wanted to do some kind of underhanded manipulative things to make sure that that wouldn't happen. And I said, be careful. If you take over your daughter's sense of self, you're actually contributing to the problem. But if you keep your boundaries, whatever they are, but you also empower her to figure it out and tell her you'll be there for her either way, I think you're creating a dynamic where she gets to figure out how to stand up to people. See, it goes back to that adage that I talk about all the time. We ask the question, why or where did our children develop this susceptibility to negative influences and peers? The answer is us. When we parent in such a way, from a place that what I feel and what I think about you is your responsibility, and you need to react to that accordingly, we wire the child's brain to believe that what peers think about them is what they should depend upon for their sense of self. And if they don't participate in certain activities, if they're not cool, if they're not edgy, then they're not accepted. That core wiring comes from us. So part of the crappy part about being a parent and raising children is, like I said earlier, that the development of self is messy and complex and nuanced. And the only way that I know how to do it, you guys, the only way I know how to do it is by working at it every day. Working on where I'm coming from, my own trauma, the scripts in my head, the messages in my head, the self-talk, my anxiety, my family of origin trauma, my need to control, all of that stuff. Working on that daily is the only way that I know how to make progress and to work and to get better at this. After 25 years of this job, thinking about it every day, watching people from a really close and unique perspective and vantage point, I've come to the conclusion that the answer is do your work for the rest of your life going forward. Figure yourself out. Make yourself the project, not the child. And when you make yourself the project, watch how the ripple effects impact and seem to change everybody around you. Somebody writes, do you have any comments on the idea of having two therapists? My son has requested to get in touch with a trauma therapist he worked with who was contracted through the residential treatment center he was at after Evoke. He's now home and working twice a week with an outpatient therapist. He says he likes his relatively new home therapist and feels safe with her. I want to honor his desire to talk with his previous therapist, yet at the same time, I worry it could get messy. His work with the contracted therapist somewhat allowed him to disengage with his primary residential treatment therapist and triangulate in the same way as done with us, mom and dad, making one good and the other bad. Any thoughts? In this specific case in question, I don't have an aversion to him working with two. You know, if a child of mine wants to meet with a therapist two or three times a week or wants to meet with two, I think I'm all for it. The dynamic of splitting, like you described, is one to pay attention to and one to guard against. But that's not your job. It's the parent's job. If he does it to you, then I don't think the equation changes if he has one or two therapists. It doesn't make sense to me to have more than one therapist, generally speaking. I don't want it as a client. And when I've had clients, I've had a couple of clients who have entertained a couple of therapists, and I don't require that they quit, meaning that they've tried certain techniques or interventions with other therapists while still visiting with me on a weekly basis. I don't make it mandatory one way or the other. That's their decision. My job is to show up the same way regardless. I have clients that have a sponsor who are very inclined to give advice and assignments, which is very different from me. It's a similar kind of dance. My job is just to be the best therapist that I can be and let the client figure that out. If it's too much money, you can set a boundary around that. From your question, I wouldn't be inclined to try to manage it. I would be on guard for the splitting as it applied to mom and dad, to you, like you said. But, and there are a lot of therapists who would be ethically opposed to it. I just don't find it to be a problem. So, thank you. Are there any live questions that have come up? Looks like we could take a pause. If you have any live questions, I'll get to them in a minute. I'll go over all the upcoming slides. We'll get back. My two books, The Journey of the Heroic Parent, which is my work based on working with families in the wilderness, and The Audacity to Be You, which is based more on my own personal work and the intensive work that I've done. Both of those are available on Amazon, and both of them have an audio version. I read The Audacity to Be You for the audio version. We have support groups. The next support group for current and alumni families in our wilderness program is September 30th. That's tomorrow night at 6:30 p.m. October 12th at 6 p.m. is for our intensives alumni, October 12th at 6. Our alumni-only program that we're doing once a month, the next available option for that is October 26th at 6:30 p.m. Malia at Evoke Therapy is the person to go for all that information and registration. We have one spot left in our Finding You, October 20th through 24th. We have one spot last I checked. This is a couple of days old. From our October 6th through 10th, Returning to You, which is if you've been through Finding You, you're available to go to Returning to You. And then we have an online version that is filling up quickly. It's half the time of Finding You in person with less than half the cost. And of course, no travel costs. So they come in part one and part two. So part one for Finding You is online November 5th through 7th. If you want a coach, a therapy, a coach who is educated in attachment-based therapy, we have coaches. Some of them are wilderness therapists. Some of them are parent coaches from other places. If you want to sign up for a parent coach who can give you the kind of work that we talk about at Evoke, contact coaching at evoketherapy.com. We also have pursuits trips, 3 to 30-day programs for people that want a refresher or kind of a therapy light. It can be for in-between programs or at the end of programs, or if you just want to reconnect to your work. We ask all current parents to try 6 12-step support groups. Any combination of Al-Anon, CODA.org, FamiliesAnonymous.org, AdultChildren.org, RefugeRecovery.org is a Buddhist-inspired program with less of an emphasis on a higher power, and then NAMI.org is the National Alliance on Mental Illness that can be provide you for classes and free services in your local area. All of these broadcasts are available on the podcast app. Just search on your favorite podcast app. It's Finding You in Evoke Therapy Podcast, or go to SoundCloud.com. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram using the handles at Evoke Therapy or at Dr. Brad Reedy. And also on Instagram, you can find the intensive program using the handle at Evoke Therapy Intensives. On Facebook, you can find us by searching Evoke Therapy Programs or Evoke Therapy Intensives. And of course, our Evoke Therapy blog has new content each week, curated by Malia Boyd, who is also our moderator for most of these. My next broadcast will be October 5th, 6:30 p.m., and I'll be talking about sibling trauma. So October 5th, 6:30 p.m., that's next week, 6:30 p.m. Mountain Time. And it looks like we don't have any other questions that have come in. Looks like we have one. No. Somebody asked the question, maybe you're going to take this. Is new alumni only group supposed to replace alumni parents from attending Thursday night or in addition? You can attend both. We only made the alumni program only so that parents who didn't want to cover the stuff that people might be covering in their first few weeks of treatment, that they didn't have to cover that. So you can come to both if you're an alumni. But if you're a current family, you don't come to the alumni only one. That's just for alumni only. All right, folks. Looks like we're all out of questions. I thought we'd go a full hour, but we only went 52 minutes this evening. Thank you for, and on behalf of your children, for doing this work. Thank you for joining us. If you want to do a deep dive into your own work, please, please, please consider the intensives at Evoke. If you don't want to go to Evoke, find other intensive programs throughout the country and do your own work, because that's the best predictor of your ability to parent your children effectively. Not how good your childhood was, not how little trauma you had in childhood, but how much you've made sense out of your childhood is the greatest predictor in your ability to parent effectively. So thank you for joining us. I hope this is a helpful point of contact. Take care, and I'll talk to you on the 5th. I think that's Tuesday. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.